Good afternoon. I would like to call the Senate Education Committee to order. We will start with a public hearing for 996. There are a couple of representatives in the room, and I'd like to ask them to come and start with testimony. If the administrator will read a little bit of a summary, we'll get going in just a second.
Vice Chair Linthicum, members of the committee. The Dash 1 Amendment to Senate Bill 996 replaces the measure. It establishes the Oregon Bright Futures Fund in the State Treasury for Post-Secondary Education Savings Program.
Apparently the administrator doesn't want to read the whole deal.
Good for her.
and that's fine. I'll assume everybody's up to speed on the Bright Horizons program, and we'll start. Who would like to start?
Yeah, I'll start off.
Thank you, Rip.
Yeah, thank you, Vice Chair Linthicum, esteemed committee members, sorry to see that Chair Roblin's not here because he's been also intimately involved in this this bill 996. It's actually a very simple concept. The concept is that every child born in Oregon would get a child savings account. The concept sounds simple, but when you try to implement it, becomes very, very complex, as you'll see as people start to talk about it. But the good news is a lot of work has been done to work through the difficulties, and I'd like to thank a lot of people who've been involved in developing this concept, really over a year of hard work to put this together. First, I'd like to thank my co-sponsors who are here with me today, other than Senator Roblin, but Representative Power and Bynum. They've put in a lot of work here, as has a lot of advocates for the concept. Jill and Janet from Neighborhood Partners, the Oregon Bankers Association, the Credit Unions of Oregon, DCBS, you'll be happy to know, also has really rolled up their sleeves and helped us develop the concepts. This concept is simple, but it's impactful. What the data shows in other cities that have similar concept in place is that it changes really the psychology of young people, of kids, and I think that's a good thing. We should bet on our young people. And what the data shows is that if you have a savings account like this, even if it's a small amount of money, say $500, it changes expectations in terms of graduation rates. And then once you graduate, actually finishing and completing college or vocational training. And I think it's time to roll up our sleeves and make these kinds of changes. It's simply not enough anymore to talk about the problems we have with regards to our education performance in the state of Oregon. It's time to do something. And I think it's time to be bold. And here is a good solution you'll see explained to you over the next half hour about how to solve this problem. So with that, I'll turn it over to my co-sponsors.
Vice Chair Linthicum, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Representative Karen Power. I represent Milwaukee, Oak Grove, and parts of Southeast Portland. I'm speaking in support of Senate Bill 996, a bill that would create a bright future for Oregon children by way of creating a new form of children's savings accounts within DCBS. We know that when families talk about education with their kids, children have better outcomes. Having just $100 in savings for higher education can be the difference in a child feeling motivated to do better versus them feeling like college or vocational training is out of reach. An unexpected financial challenge might wipe out a family's savings. Savings that may have been intended for future educational costs, but may be instead tapped for medical costs or other household needs. Currently, we have few different savings accounts options in Oregon, like the 529 plan. These current options do not meet the needs of all parents and guardians, though. We need savings mechanisms that work for the families for whom 529 investment accounts are out of reach. Through this bill, we have worked closely to design, from the ground up, a plan that will reach kids least likely to be reached by current mechanisms and ensure those savings will be there when the child needs them down the road. We don't currently have a savings mechanism that reaches low and moderate income kids. This is an exciting opportunity. I'll let the others speak more to that later.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Linthicum. Oh, I knew I was going to kill it. Linthicum. There we go. It's as bad as Bynum. we're Bynum, Bynum, by which, whatever. My name is Janelle Bynum, and I'm the State Representative for House District 51 here in Oregon. I'm testifying today in support of Senate Bill 996 because I believe the concept of helping families build generational wealth is extremely important, and we have a chance here today to help them do so. Many families in Oregon experience barriers to entry for savings when they have so many other things going on in their lives and competing for their personal and financial attention. Various backgrounds and cultural differences sometimes make meaningful savings accounts seem out of reach. So with this bill, we'd create a brick-and-mortar option that families can easily track and access. Promoting the habit of saving for the next generation will help more families plan for their future and their children's educations. So to support this, I believe that families should have multiple on-ramps to saving for college. And some would ask, why would we have more than one option, like we have 529s and other options? But to them, I just point to the example of life insurance. So some people use it for providing a financial cushion when a loved one has been lost. Some people use it as income replacement. Others use it as an inheritance. And still others use it to pay taxes on an estate. You can obtain life insurance at work, through an agent, online, at a bank, multiple places. It's one product, has different uses, and multiple access points. Just like insurance, these child savings accounts can be used for different educational purposes, and that's why I think having more than one option for Oregon families is appealing. So Senate Bill 996 applies this concept to savings accounts, and I hope you'll join me in supporting it. Thanks for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. We have, are there any questions arising? Yes.
Thanks. I think I'm still looking for a way. First of all, I'm supportive of this concept. How do you see it working? Can you, like, go out, like, 5 years from now if this passes where, we've talked about this over the years of, like, starting new childbirths with a 529 fund and the state seeds $50 or something.
Mm-hmm.
How does this work?
Yeah. Matter of fact, take it. Yeah. I'd see in 5 years, say, let's say a child born in 2 years and 5 years, so when they're starting, say, first grade, that those accounts would be implemented and used through their local financial institution. So the master account is held in the Oregon Treasury, but the sub-account is actually accessed through the local financial institution. Those accounts would be deposited with either personal dollars, public dollars, or charitable foundation dollars. It'd be linked to a performance criteria, to a life plan, goals. It could even be tied to staying in school, attendance rates, and there could be incentive payments into those accounts. And then once they're done with high school, the dollars could be used either for college, university, or vocational training.
So if I may, Mr. Chair, you're young parents, you have a child, state has this account for junior, and how does money get deposited into it?
Three ways. Either they can directly give to the account and open it in a local financial institution, or we could in the future create some program to fund it with state dollars. That's not part of this proposal. Or say the Oregon Community Foundation has targeted a certain geographic area or community or performance metric in certain school district that they want to put dollars in, or more charitable foundation, say a city like Philomath used to have a similar program. They could just say every child in Philomath gets X amount of dollars. So lots of flexibility. This just creates the format, the structure to activate these accounts.
And it's probably in one of the twos that I haven't seen. But how do you withdraw from it? Are there ways to keep people from taking it out?
There are. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There's restrictions on use of the funds.
Yeah.
And this will be covered in more detail.
Yeah, thank you.
Any other questions? I've got a question, and any one of you can feel free to answer it. In terms of you referenced 529s as alternatives in having those different tools, 529s, you can change beneficiaries and those sort of things. Is that available in the CSA environment?
I think the testimony behind us will give a little more illumination to the technicalities of it, and a lot of it is still being fleshed out. But again, like I talked about before, you want to maintain some sort of flexibility around the plan. I think the testimony will be that the state of Oregon would be the account owner.
The master account.
Yeah, and then the child will be the beneficiary or something like that. I may not get the technical terms right, but that is the intent.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, no other questions. The next panel can come up, and the next panel will be Melissa Hicks, Jill Windsor, and Pam Levitt. Thank you.
Vice Chair Linthicum, I do believe Rebecca Loya was going to be on the phone.
You had her listed fourth.
Oh, okay. Okay, good afternoon, Vice Chair Linthicum and members of the committee. My name is Melissa Hicks, and I work at Self Enhancement, Inc. in Northeast Portland, and I also serve on the steering committee for the Oregon Asset Building Coalition. I am here today to ask your support of Senate Bill 996. Self Enhancement, Inc. works to support the success of youth in our community. For those of you not familiar with our work, I provided some background from my submitted testimony. As a culture-specific organization that primarily serves the African-American community, we have a long track record of success in spite of the challenges that our kids in our communities face. We see children's savings accounts, like what is proposed on the Oregon Bright Futures Plan, as a powerful tool that we could use to have an even more impact with the children and families we serve. Children's savings accounts, as you will hear from our next witness, are a proven, exciting tool. They're good for kids, good for parents, and good for communities. We at Self Enhancement see many possibilities to incorporate them into our work and are excited by the impacts they promise. As a community-based partner, CSAs are a tool for our families that are most impacted by financial barriers in achieving post-secondary education. We believe CSAs will instill two things that our community needs: an increase in financial healthy habits, as well as a developed sense of college identity at a young age. Most exciting from our perspective is that as a community with unique strengths and unique challenges, we will be able to use the Oregon Bright Futures Plan in ways that work for us. It's both universal, every child in Oregon will have a Bright Future account, and adaptable so that it will support our kids and families. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'm going to turn it over to Jill Windsor. Did you want to do Rebecca? Okay. Jill Windsor.
Great, thank you. Mm-hmm. Vice Chair Linthicum, members of the committee, my name is Jill Windsor. I'm the Financial Innovations Director at Neighborhood Partnerships, and I staff the Oregon Asset Building Coalition. Thank you for allowing me the time to present today. We believe that all children in Oregon should be encouraged to dream big and to plan for their future. The Oregon Bright Futures Plan is a children's savings account platform that encourages families to start planning for post-high school opportunities as soon as they are born. My task here today is to walk you through what this bill does. So Senate Bill 996 with the -1 amendments will authorize the Department of Consumer and Business Services to develop the Oregon Bright Futures Plan and to begin a pilot, which would launch as soon as January 1, 2018. The bill creates the Oregon Bright Futures Fund. The fund will be a mix of grants, contributions, or state appropriations. The bill requires that on a quarterly basis, the Center for Health Statistics will provide DCBS with information about each child born in the state of Oregon. You'll see testimony from Oregon Health Authority indicating their ability to provide that information. Once money becomes available, either from state appropriations or grants or contributions received, Department of Consumer and Business Services will design the Oregon Bright Futures Plan and rule, including developing an account structure for Oregon Bright Futures accounts to be held at Oregon banks and credit unions, which voluntarily elect to participate, managing a request for proposals process to identify financial institution partners who want to hold those accounts, and as needed, conducting an RFP process to select a technology platform provider. And that technology platform is expected to be an off-the-shelf product, just simply linking those children's accounts with community-based incentives. We also have House Bill 3367 with Dash 1 amendments that would prompt a discussion of possible general fund contributions to DCBS to allow for a small dollar seed payment into each account, and we're looking at about $25 for each child. Once the program is designed, implementation of the Oregon Bright Futures pilot will launch. DCBS will communicate with mothers, allowing them to choose which financial institution will hold their account and how they can start to save in those accounts. DCBS will open a Bright Futures account for each child within the pilot area. Pilots will test the impact of program design features on participation, engagement, and behavior. DCBS will work to determine the best way to scale the program statewide with an eye toward minimizing costs for the state as well as financial institutions and community partners. Community institutions and partners will be recruited to provide grants or incentives to children or to support family engagement. And in my written testimony, you'll see an outline of the goals and metrics we have for this pilot phase, but I did want to highlight that really most importantly, we want to make sure that all children in Oregon have the possibility of thinking about a brighter future. And that's why we've designed an opt-out universal platform. We want to reach the children that are least likely to have savings set aside for post-secondary education. And to that point, ensuring that children from families with limited means are able to imagine that brighter future, and we really are required to facilitate the support of community partners and organizations that families trust. When those community partners and organizations wrap around families and are able to encourage them to engage in the platform, that's when we'll be able to see the changes in attitudes, hopes, and expectations. Allowing local community-based organizations, funders, and others to develop incentive and scholarship programs means that we're able to target resources where they are most needed. And we've had contact with foundations and the other partners who have indicated really strong support for this once legislative support is actualized. When fully funded, the Oregon Bright Futures Plan will open accounts for each child at birth, and that's about 45,000 children a year. But during that pilot phase, we anticipate opening between 5,000 to 10,000 accounts. In 2020, the legislature will hear a report on family participation and engagement with the Oregon Bright Futures Plan. We hope that you will support this effort to bring communities together in new ways to create a brighter future for Oregon's children. Thank you.
Go ahead, Pam.
Okay. Chair Roblin and members of the committee, I'm Pam Levitt, and I represent the Northwest Credit Union Association and all Oregon credit unions. It's such a pleasure to be before the Senate Education Committee, and normally when I do come before the education committees, I am talking about financial literacy and financial education, and Senate Bill 996 certainly meets with those goals. I submitted some written testimony. I just wanted to let you know that we participated on the Technical Advisory Committee to help create this. Senate Bill 996 fits very well into our goals of helping youth with their savings. We have several programs around the state that really help with youth financial education, and Senate Bill 996 fits part of that. We're specifically very interested in the role of DCBS setting up this program and the role of financial institutions. I will tell you there's a lot of technical work yet to be done with DCBS in these accounts, and we certainly want to be participating. There's a lot of questions that haven't been answered but will be, and we support the bill, we support this program, and we want to be part of the discussions moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for any of the people here? Senator Hess, is that a question? Okay. No questions. Thank you very much. We're going to go to the phone right now. Hello, Rebecca. This is Senator Arnie Roblin in our Senate Education Committee meeting in Oregon. And
hello.
We have had some testimony already to begin with, and we would love to hear from you regarding Bright Futures or the Senate Bill 996 that we have here.
Okay. Wonderful. And I just wanted to confirm, are my slides being shown there?
Oh, do we have slides up?
No.
We do not.
We do not? Okay, no problem. We don't need them.
Okay.
I just wanted to make sure.
Okay.
So for the record, my name is Rebecca Loya. I am a senior research associate at the Institute on Assets and Social Policy at Brandeis University. And I am here today to share some of the compelling research findings on children's savings accounts in support of the Oregon Bright Futures Plan. I have also submitted detailed written testimony as well as a recent review of the literature as background. So the value of CSAs goes well beyond what families' saved dollars can afford. The research shows that having savings for post-secondary education is associated with improved social-emotional development for very young children, starting as young as age 4, better academic performance in school, higher educational expectations among both parents and children, and a greater likelihood of attending and completing college. These benefits of CSAs are especially powerful for children from low and moderate income families. Beyond the benefits for the focal child who has the account, CSAs also offer benefits for the whole family, and these include improved maternal mental health, connecting parents with financial literacy education opportunities, and greater access to regulated financial institutions and to credit. So to ensure that CSAs reach the children who need them most, programs must include specific features that include low and moderate income families. The research shows that the most effective strategies to create meaningful access for lower income families include using a universal opt-out approach, offering a savings match or other incentives, partnering with community organizations for outreach, utilizing account structures that are familiar to families at local financial institutions, and accepting deposits in a variety of formats, including in person and in cash. The Oregon Bright Futures Plan includes many of these essential features and thus is likely to create real and lasting change for Oregon children. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I would be happy to answer any questions.
So, any questions for our person? I just want to say that we certainly appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about us, and in particular, I think the characteristics of a plan that has the best value for our poorest community, actually, and that middle class group that sometimes can't save otherwise, and specifically letting us know what the research is doing. Would also be helpful if you didn't put it in your testimony that you sent, what research is out there and where we could find it so we could have the original documentation.
Absolutely. I think you'll find the report that my institute recently published called Leverage for Success, which I included as background, will be a really helpful resource. It looks at a large swath of the published research on CSAs, including cases going on in the state of Maine, the state of Nevada, as well as cities of San Francisco and Oakland, and what features they include which most effectively reach low-income families.
Okay.
I think that'll be a useful resource for you. I'd be happy to speak to any specific features if folks have specific questions.
Any other questions? No, thank you. Looking at those documents would be helpful. So I appreciate the information you sent and your time today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You can stay on and listen if you want, or you can get back to your regular job. So it's up to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Next, we have Kara Thompson, Kevin Christensen, Pat Allen, and Quinn Collins. And if you can get another chair up there, we can get all four of you if you want. I know it's sometimes helpful to have other people around you to make you feel more comfortable. And if there's somebody that doesn't need to be up there, that's fine, too.
I don't see Kevin.
Okay. We're good. He used to be one of our people that sat up here helping out as an administrator, and then he's not here. It's really sad. Okay. Whoever wants to start.
All right, thank you. My name is Kara Thompson, and I am here on behalf of Columbia Bank. I serve as Chief Compliance Officer, and one of my responsibilities is oversight of our compliance with the Community Reinvestment Act. On a personal note, I am a person who would have benefited from a program like this, having come from a moderate income household and not having attended college. I am working through that, chipping away at it with a full-time career at this point in time in my life. My bank looks at this as an opportunity to be innovative. We do a whole lot under the umbrella of the Community Reinvestment Act. However, most of that is aimed at housing, and what we're increasingly seeing is that there is a divide that is growing between the haves and the have-nots, and we are seeing in our communities throughout Oregon the effects on our communities with respect to drug use and so on and so forth, related to people who don't feel that they have an opportunity. We see this particular program as an opportunity to develop curriculum on financial literacy and to provide us access into our schools to start at the earliest points in conversation with children and their families on how to save. And we're excited to work with the state in the development of that curriculum, and we're excited to open our doors of our branches to the families and the children to come on in and make deposits and learn how to interact with the bank. Many of these people who are going to be benefiting from this program are unbanked or underbanked, and we look forward to this being an opportunity to solve for that.
Thank you.
My name is, good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Quinn Collins, and I work with College Dreams in Southern Oregon. I'm also on the steering committee for the Oregon Asset Building Coalition. Since 2009, College Dreams has been fortunate to partner with the Oregon IDA Initiative, working with youth as young as 12 while they save towards their education and create hope for the future. We've served over 500 youth through this program and have seen the power that matched savings have in terms of building college savings and also building college band identity. Several years ago, interest grew internally to see how we could leverage that effect for the more than 1,200 students we serve each year, not just those we're able to enroll in our program. So what we did is we started researching children's savings accounts to better understand what would fit the population that we serve. And we quickly found that many of the models that existed were not accessible for the low-income, underrepresented, and first-generation students that we serve in our rural communities. So as you've heard about the design elements, I just want to echo that they're based on research and also based on focus groups that we did, some of which with the youth that we serve in Southern Oregon, and we believe that we're on the right track with this design. I also want to talk today about why children's savings accounts are so important. The community that I grew up in and now have the pleasure to serve is not known for its college-going culture. Kids don't grow up believing that they'll do anything significant after high school and may in fact have their dreams discouraged by parents who don't want their kids to have unrealistic expectations. My job is to change that culture, and children's savings accounts provide the opportunity to have a really powerful tool to accomplish that. The importance of building college band identity, I will say, was really highlighted for me with two of the students I had the opportunity to first work with when we enrolled them in fourth and fifth grade. And so we enrolled them in College Dreams, and we're able to enroll them in our IDA program when they turned 12. When we first met them, college was not something that they really saw as possible or something that was in their future. And so this last year, I had the opportunity to reflect with them around what having access to a savings vehicle and matching incentives really meant for them. And this is what they happened to say. They said it ignited the flame of possibility of college, that the road to college was going to remain stable and was going to be possible for us to be successful as students. I strongly feel the savings account we have is the foundation we can build upon. And that alone helped me grasp to the idea that college was possible and that having this money set aside specifically for college means I know that I can reach my goal. So now those two students, one of them happens to be a freshman at Shemeckene Community College, and the other just found out she received a full ride to Lewis and Clark. Their experience highlights why we need a universal tool that can reach across our state, ensuring all youth have the opportunity to build higher education expectations for themselves and see what is possible. So thank you for the opportunity to share about the Oregon Bright Futures Plan. When we finish our testimony, I'd be happy to take any questions that you have.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I'm the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The agency has no position on the bill. I think I'm mostly here to be a utility infielder for technical questions you might have about implementation. I would make just a couple of brief comments. The intent of the proponents is for us to use the authority in the bill to run a pilot that would be more limited than a full statewide implementation. Even with that, and we've talked with the proponents about the fact that the bill is likely to have a fiscal, although a modest one. I think as we run any kind of a pilot that comes from this, one of the things that we're going to be most acutely interested in trying to manage for is scalability of what we do at the pilot level. With 40 to 45,000 births per year in you know, a handful of years, you'd potentially have a quarter million of these accounts, and needing to be able to think about how to manage this in a way that doesn't become unwieldy over time is probably our biggest concern as we look to how to design that pilot and what we can learn from it and recommendations we would make going forward. I'd be happy to answer any questions anyone has.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
That was it.
Is there anyone else that would like to speak to this bill because they got so excited hearing about it that they want to jump up now and get their voice on the record? I'm not seeing anybody. Oh, I saw someone move, but then she got back down. Oh, sorry. So with that, we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 996. Stay tuned for future as we move this bill, or I think there's one also in the House that was hearing at the same day, so we'll figure out where we're going and what we're going to do with this. And thank you, Representative Bueller, for being here. I guess I could thank your aide, too, because he's worked hard on this. And thank you all for coming. Okay. So we're going to, before I do we have some representatives from Treasury here?
Yes.
Okay. I'm good then. So I'm going, oh, thank you. I didn't see you there. We're going to open work sessions on both 758 and 759 because it makes it easier for testifying. And so with that, we'll have a short explanation of the two bills, and then we'll bring up whoever you want to bring with you as our Treasury group. You can start coming up now if you want.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 758 establishes refundable tax credit for contributions to higher education savings network accounts. It establishes tax credit for corporations that contribute to higher education savings network accounts for their employees, allows taxpayers to subtract set amounts from their taxable income per beneficiary of a higher education savings network account or an account set up under the provisions of the Achieving a Better Life Experience Act. It extends tax credits to S corporations for contributions to higher education savings accounts, effective 91 days after the Legislative Assembly adjourns sine die. Senate Bill 759 specifies that account balances in a higher education savings account may not be counted when determining an individual's eligibility for public benefits for determinations made on or after January 1, 2018. Declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Bell. I'm the managing director of the Oregon 529 Savings Network. That is a fancy name for the small division there at Treasury that manages the Oregon College Savings Plans and the new Oregon ABLE Savings Plans. I am here to testify in support of both Senate Bill 758 and 759. Just a little bit of background on the Oregon College Savings Plan, which is more of what these bills are focused on. It launched in 2001. In that first year, we had over 10,000 accounts and $33 million in assets. It meant that people really needed to have an avenue to save for future education needs of their kids. I think that today was a very appropriate day because I think that's a big focus of what we're doing here is making sure that people have the opportunity to save for their future and allow their children to reach their aspirations. Just to give a little bit of insight, so that was after the first year. At the end of 2016, we had 174,000 accounts in the Oregon College Savings Plans and $2.7 billion in assets, which is impressive. That means $2.7 billion set aside for our futures, youth to go to college, to go to trade school, to go to universities, higher education in general. Again, I'm in support of Senate Bill 758 specifically. Very excited about the opportunity for a low-income tax credit. I think you heard some testimony earlier, obviously on a different bill, but the focus is we want every Oregonian to have the opportunity to be saving for their kids' future. The Oregon College Savings Plan can get started with as low as $25, and that's not a fee. That's just the first amount put in, and it can be less than that. Because of that large amount of assets, we were able to lower our fees extremely low. We're competitive for college savings plans throughout the nation, which is exciting. We support this bill, 758, because of the low-income tax credit, the employer tax credit, and also the deduction per beneficiary for the parents, because incentives work, and we have some examples of how they do. And maybe I could speak to that part first before talking about Senate Bill 759. We do a lot of incentives. We've built our assets to a point to where we can do that. We have some funds to do that. We fully run off of our management fees, which, like I said, are extremely low, so we're not pulling funds from the legislator for this program specifically. So we have seed programs. This year we just wrapped up a kindergarten seed program where we had 17 schools districts where every kindergartner had the opportunity of opening up a college savings plan, and we'd seed it with the first $25. That went extremely well. We also had sweepstakes in all the schools because we believe in community partners. We want them to help us disseminate this information. We have one specific program that I'd like to highlight because it's really impressive, is the baby grad program. So for 2015 and 2016, only in the months January through March, we offered a program. So any child that had been born in the previous 12 months could open up a college savings account, and we would just seed it with $25. $25 doesn't sound like a lot, but it meant a lot. Here's some of the statistics. In just those 2 years of programs, the total of 6 months, three in 2015 and 2016, a total of 1,500 accounts were opened over these two campaigns. The $25 seed means that we invested, the Oregon College Savings Plan invested about $38,000 into this to seed those first accounts. When those accounts were open, the parents didn't just take that seed. They invested an additional $2.2 million when they opened these accounts, and 96% of these accounts had additional contributions totaling $6 million. So basically, we leveraged $38,000 of our own money in order to turn it into $8.2 million in college savings. Incentives work, and that's why we see the opportunities for some of these low-income tax credits, employer tax credits, et cetera. We want to get the process started, allow families to continue to fund these accounts, which they are proven that they'll do, and make sure that those conversations about going to college, going to trade school, are happening and earlier on. And so that is why we support Senate Bill 758. And then just quickly, we support Senate Bill 759 for two main reasons. One is it's another incentive for low-income families to save for college. Basically, they would have an avenue to save for their higher education of their kids and not be worried about getting kicked off of some of the vital benefits that they might be relying on. It also, the second reason we support this, it better mimics what we do with the Oregon ABLE Savings Plan. ABLE Savings is for individuals with disabilities and their families, but that same type of terminology is in that plan. So it brings the two plans a little bit closer together that we manage. And just to wrap this up, I know I've taken more time than I should on this. College savings does matter. It matters now and it matters later. Some of the testimony that was given earlier is true. There are statistics done by the Corporation for Enterprise Development that children that have college savings accounts, middle school and high school students with college savings, doesn't even have to be a lot, have higher math scores. This is one that we love, and I think maybe it was mentioned earlier, the same group, Corporation for Enterprise Development, with less than $500 saved, a child is three times more likely to enroll in college and four times more likely to graduate from college than a child that has no money set aside for college. And so we feel like we have a very good place for people to be able to start this. We have a great outreach team to be able to educate and be able to move this forward. These two bills would help greatly to help us incentivize families to move forward and continue to communicate and motivate them to put money aside for their future. Thank you for this time, and I'm happy to try to answer any questions anybody might have.
Yes, Senator Lithgow.
Since you have a lot of facts at your fingertips, out of the 174,000 accounts and $2.7 billion in assets, what were the fees that you were charging back to those 174,000 Either one, I'd love to know what the total was. Two, I'd love to know on average what that looks like.
Chair Roblin and Vice Chair Lithicum, let me try to answer that, but then I am more than happy to actually get you more specific data. I can tell you that our budget for the biennium is $6 million. That is $6 million that we're pulling from our program. So we get funds from our program through basis points. We also have to cover some costs for some program management, which for the Oregon College Savings Plan is TIA CREF, I guess they're now just TIA. So in that, our budget is $3 million per year, $6 million per biennium. I know that that doesn't directly answer your question, but it almost does in that that's the money that we're pulling from the plan, and that's the money that we're getting from those fees. One little caveat, with college savings, program managers have so much assets under management that many of those program managers are actually handing money back to the state to do additional marketing. So that $6 million also includes that, and that's the number I don't have the exact amount for. We utilize a good portion of that on marketing and outreach, a pretty small amount on the management of the program because there's only four or five of us full-time employees, but really trying to get the word back to individuals, and then also a decent size on these seed programs and sweepstakes programs.
Just a quick follow-up. With regard to that, what was the average because it's such a large bundle, I'm sure you've got it invested wherever. What was the average return on that investment?
Chair Roblin and Vice Chair Lithicum, I better be careful on that one because we actually have 15 different investment options, okay. And that's completely decided by the individuals. We have some investment options which are basically FDIC-insured, you know, savings accounts that are probably bringing back very little for those families, all the way through to socially responsible options. And then our most popular is the age base. All of those come with different returns. All of those are in some sort of a mutual fund style, so it is up and down depending on the year.
Right. And just in conversational mode, you mentioned basis points, and I'm thinking this has got to be very minuscule returns. If it's in mutual funds, maybe better given the current stock market. But it would be advantageous for us to see what that looks like, especially in light of the bill we just heard with regard to the the Healthy Horizons bill. What was
it's
that
really
called?
Healthy
Promises, something or other.
Yep.
Chair Roblin and Vice Chair Lithicum, we can definitely get you that data. In fact, and I'm not asking you to do this, but on our website for the Oregon College Savings Plan, we highlight every single one of our options, what they've done over the last year, what they've done over the last 5 years, 10 years. But I know what you're asking. I believe what you're asking is, what is the average return on investment for an account in the Oregon College Savings Plan? I do know that we're tracking extremely well when it comes to comparing ourselves to the other state 529 savings plans. We also have a third-party investment consultant that we pay to make sure that the investments that are chosen are the right ones, and if they need to be adjusted, are adjusted accordingly. But our board makes that final decision. Am I correct in saying that you would like to see some data on what the average return on investment is for our accounts?
Thank you.
Any other questions of this witness? I appreciate you being here. I appreciate your obvious knowledge of this program. It was very well done. I mean, I think that's really helpful. The asset growth has been pretty remarkable, realizing how much money are in those accounts. An average account based on yearly kind of things, how much people are putting aside?
How much? Oh, so the average, Chair Roblin, the average account size for the Oregon College Savings Plan is similar to a lot of others, and we're about $12,000 right now. There are some states, so $12,000, when I look at my children's Oregon College Savings Plan, that number scares me because I'm not close to that number, but I need to get there. but as the data shows, you know, it's okay if you're not quite to that amount. We do spend quite a bit of time talking about some financial literacy aspects as well. I spent the last 10 years prior working for the Oregon College Savings Plan, working with many of the people that were here today. I was the director of operations for a global nonprofit, and it is important to have those conversations, whether there is $25,000 saved for college or $3,000 or $300 saved for college. But thank you. We're passionate about what we do. We want to get this information out to those that need it the most, and I will follow up with data that will be helpful to this committee.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Have we gotten information on fizz and riz on these? How much does it cost? Any of that kind of stuff?
Not yet.
We haven't asked that yet. Okay. Thank you very much. With that, is there anyone else? Again, I will offer, even if you didn't write your name down, this is your last opportunity to get up, come here, and have a conversation. I don't see one, so we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bills 758, 759. And we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1002. That will have a short explanation of the bill. Whoever's here wants to come up. Amy, do you want to come on up? Thank you. And bring anybody you want. Okay. And we'll have a short explanation from our administrator.
Maybe.
He'll be here in a second.
We haven't started.
Yeah, you can come on up. I said anyone who wanted to help them can be here. We're waiting to get it up on the screen so we can read our analysis of the bill. So we're almost there.
Chair Rowland, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1002 requires school districts to allow the use of school facilities by public school students and private tutors under certain circumstances. It requires public and tribal libraries to adopt policies allowing the use of library facilities by students and private tutors under certain circumstances. The Dash 1 Amendment allows schools and libraries to charge a fee of up to $50 per year. It specifies that school policies must allow the use of school buildings both before and after school. Declares emergency effective July 1st.
Okay. With that, whoever wants to start first.
I'll start. Chair Roble, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Senate District 8, which includes Corvallis and Philomath. So I was very pleased to get the opportunity to chat with this family and some others last year and to speak with some school district personnel at that time about the challenges that families have really helping their students succeed in school. And I think it's very timely that we have the dyslexia bill work session up later today because many of the students and families that I've talked to actually are experiencing dyslexia. The issue that is arising is that kids struggle in school, and we know that it is not always possible for the school to provide all the additional support that a student needs in order to move forward and make progress. And we know that we've set some pretty aggressive goals in our state, 40-40-20, and I continue to believe that the most challenging part of 40-40-20 is getting everybody across that stage in high school to graduate from high school. If you are struggling with your reading and math in elementary school and you aren't meeting your third grade reading benchmark or you're falling behind in elementary school, we know that that puts you at a greater disadvantage in terms of your likelihood of graduating from high school. And that's why so many parents seek out private tutors in order to help support their students to keep up in school and to get that extra attention and support that they need. The problem is that 8-year-olds and 9-year-olds and 10-year-olds
don't drive. Their parents are often working, and the children are not able to ride a city bus on their own. They're not able to go across town to a tutor's office or to a library. And where they often are after school is at an after-school program that is held on a school district property or within a school building. So what this bill simply asks is that if a school is already open, so we're not asking that the school open especially for this, but if the school is already open and the school library is open, a space is open, that a child be allowed to meet with their tutor in order to get that support to make progress with their schoolwork. Without that opportunity, many kids are not able to access that tutor. For some families, they may have to leave work in order to transport them. Other families, more high-income families, may be able to afford to hire someone to drive their kids from the after-school program to the tutor and back to the after-school program. But that is just not available to many low-income families. And finally, it's just not fair to kids to not be able to access a tutor to move forward in their schoolwork if the school building is going to be open anyway. I am certainly very open to any amendments to make sure that people are appropriately criminal background checked, but there is a tremendous educational benefit to kids being able to access their tutors. When kids are older, it's a little bit easier. I know that one of my children uses two different tutors for two different subjects. She meets one of them at a Starbucks and one of them at a Fred Meyer, and that's how a lot of these tutoring situations work out. But for younger kids, that simply is not possible, and they are not going to be able to succeed in school if they are not able to access those tutoring services.
Okay, thank you. It's up to you. You get to say whatever you want.
Chair Roblin, Senator Gelser, thank you. Members of the committee, my name is Amy Angel, and I'm here as a parent in support of Senate Bill 1002. Our daughter, Mackenzie, is currently in fourth grade, but on her first day of second grade, the class was asked to draw a picture of how they were feeling about the first day of school. Mackenzie drew a picture of several students lined up at their desks. The children all had huge smiles and were looking down at their papers with gold stars on them, all except for her. In her picture, Mackenzie had drawn herself with a frown and tears streaming down her face, and the paper on her desk had a large red X across it. A picture is worth 1,000 words, and we didn't need any words to know that something was deeply wrong. We had Mackenzie privately assessed, and she was diagnosed as dyslexic. Mackenzie is now halfway through an intensive tutoring system, which is proven to teach dyslexic students. Her tutor meets with her year-round, one-on-one, two times a week, for an hour at a time. We have seen incredible results from her tutoring as her reading, writing, and spelling have improved markedly. Even more importantly, Mackenzie no longer dreads school. Her confidence is up, and she will even pick up a book to read just for fun, especially graphic novels that have lots of pictures and very few words. She does still have a long way to go. Last year, when Mackenzie was in third grade, her tutor met with her in the school library after school. At the beginning of the fourth grade, the school district abruptly turned our tutor away and informed us that we must comply with the community use of district facilities policy and pay a $50 per hour fee to use a table in the corner of the library. This would be in addition to the $50 per hour fee we were already paying the specialized tutor. This policy was similar to the sample policies submitted today by the Oregon School Boards Association for your record. We asked the school board to waive this facility use fee, which they denied. Instead, the board amended its policy to prohibit paid private tutors from music district facilities at all. As a result, we were forced to move our daughter's tutoring sessions to the evenings. In fact, she has one tonight when we get home. These sessions are significantly less effective compared to when she was tutored in the afternoon, as in the evening she is exhausted and has little to no focus at the end of a long day. Our story is not unique. Many parents and tutors have submitted their stories as written testimony, including a tutor who has tutored students in her car outside of a school. This was because there was nowhere else to take the child in the time that she had to tutor the student. We urge you to review these statements from the community carefully. We personally know several families in just our school and in our school district which have been forced to find alternative locations for tutoring. This tutoring is absolutely critical for these students as the schools are not yet equipped to teach dyslexic students to read, write, and spell. We do find it curious that the school districts want to both eschew their duty to provide a free, appropriate public education to dyslexic learners and oppose training teachers about dyslexia, but also put up unnecessary roadblocks to families who turn to private tutors as a last resort. The policies that they have that ban private tutors or impose cost-prohibitive fees exist alongside ones that permit local neighborhood association groups, scout troops, and others to use school facilities without cost. Additionally, unpaid volunteers are also provided free access to work with students, even during school hours. When we inquired why these groups could use the facilities and our tutor couldn't, the district pointed to the fact that our tutor works for pay. Good tutors for dyslexic learners are few and far between, and they are not free. The irony of imposing a facility use fee on private tutoring means the districts are profiting off kids with learning disabilities. Either that, or the fee is imposed as a de facto ban on tutors. Either way, these policies create an unnecessary burden on families whose children desperately need supplemental educational support. We urge you to break down these barriers to struggling students and ask you to support Senate Bill 1002 as amended and require school districts to have compliant policies in place before the next school year. Thank you.
Any questions?
No, I don't have anything to add.
Okay. No, nothing to add?
Nothing to add.
Okay. You're sure?
I think she covered it really, really well. I had some notes, and they're going to be redundant at this point.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, if I may, the bill itself, when I was calling around last summer, there actually are some policies that some districts and libraries noted that they have a concern that state law might actually prohibit them from allowing this to occur, and that is why the bill includes libraries as well, and it's why I believe a bill is needed rather than just going to work on something more informally, because several places cited the idea that you couldn't use a public place for private gain. This is very narrowly tailored in order to ensure what we're talking about is an educational benefit for a child, and it's certainly consistent with the use of a public school or the use of a public library that we'd be using that to support the learning of students.
Any other questions? Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So next we have Nan Heim, Morgan Allen, and Lori Satinsbill. We'll go with Nan first.
Chair Robland, Vice Chair Linthicum, members of the committee, my name is Nan Heim, and I represent the Oregon Library Association. Our members do include public libraries, and they asked me to testify in opposition to this bill. When I sent the bill to them, they responded that they welcome everybody in public libraries and that they already have policies addressing the use. Some of them have very small facilities and don't have the space for people to use them for long periods of time. That was the major concern I heard, that if you have certain groups using the space for a long time, then other groups aren't allowed in because there isn't any room for them. Some libraries have public meeting rooms that they can and do rent out, but they all have policies in place. And I think that this can be addressed on the local level. The policies are reviewed every 3 years, or someone can go to the governing board and ask for review. And I think that the decisions would be made based on the space that the facility has. But they were very anxious to convey that people are welcome at public libraries, as long as the use is reasonable and others are allowed in. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Lori Satinsbill for the Oregon School Boards, here in opposition to the bill today. As was noted, we did put on some sample district policies, and as you know, the district takes those policies and makes them their own based on their own community needs, whether the size of the district, the facilities, and what the community needs. In looking at the bill directly, if this bill is going to move forward, we do have concerns, and noted Senator Gelser spoke to some of those about background checks. You know, what if this person wants to pack a weapon into the building, those kinds of things that we would be concerned with. If someone fails a background check, can we deny them to come in? So there's some areas that we'd like to sort out if your intent is to change the law and move the bill forward. We would like to continue to work with the district and other districts if this is happening to see if we can sort out the issues and come to some helpful solution, because it is our hope that kids would succeed, and that takes a village. And on the 529 bill, you know, I really like that bill. My daughter, as a college student, is saving for grad school and using that feature. And I said, that's really awesome. Keep saving. So with that, I would be happy to take questions. Again, districts all have policy in place. And it's the discretion of the board and the superintendent on fees and how that is, how that's done locally.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Morgan Allen on behalf of the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. And I had an opportunity today to speak to the assistant superintendent in Lake Oswego, which is the school district in question. And I think our perspective is that these are local facilities, and these decisions should be made at the local level by the locally elected school board and the administrators. And if the community members and patrons of the school district disagree with the policies of the district, they already have an ability to try to redress those by going to the school board or filing a complaint or trying to change the policy. And we don't think it's the appropriate role of the state legislature to step in and tell local school districts who they can and can't allow into their buildings. So we do oppose the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions?
Yes.
Thank you. Is there some middle ground here? I mean, the Angels have said that they did go to the school board. They do have a tutor. My kids have had tutors in years gone by. And it doesn't seem like an unreasonable request. Is there? I don't think there would be an
sure.
If they are agreeing to background checks and all of those things, it seems like there's some middle ground here.
So, Chair Roblin and Senator Haas, I'm going to, in this situation, use the often overused slippery slope argument. And that is, if we come in and start legislating specific groups of people or specific organizations or specific folks get to use schools, regardless of whether or not that locally elected school board and the administration and the community decide that's an appropriate use of their school facilities, then I guarantee we'll be back here every session with bills asking for new groups of folks to be able to use the facilities.
You want to answer that question, too?
Yeah, Chair Roblin, Senator, I also talked with the school district about this and I actually asked Senator if we could put the bill off to see if we could work with a solution. And the deputy is out of town, and I know that Senator Gelser spoke with the district as well and felt like there was some digging into the heels. And I would like to continue to see if we could find some middle ground. And I agree with Morgan, once this legislation starts, it's going to continue.
Well, I think everybody wants to get to the same place here. And sometimes, I mean, if you adhere to the no slippery slope argument, you'll never change anything. And you just will remain the status quo forever. So, I mean, I think part of our responsibility is to be flexible to the needs of people who petition us and ask for help. And I just don't think what they're asking to do is all that unreasonable.
Yes, Senator Wolfgang.
With regard to the slippery slope, I think your point is hollow. If this tutor were not charging, he could come in with the student and use any desk in the library any time of day that the library is open, and they could have conversations in a tutoring session. No harm, no foul, no school district would be involved. It's the no gain rule that is the stumbling block. It's not a background check. Nobody knows if he was packing or not packing. That's also hollow. So I think the issue is making a cutout for individuals who are focusing on educational purposes. It's not which group, it's what purpose. The purpose is clearly educational. The purpose is clearly getting a dyslexic child on the fast track instead of leaving them off the bus. And I think it's legitimate. This is certainly a legitimate request. If I've heard anything in this committee, it's 1,000 different things this is clearly a legitimate request, and finding neutral ground where both sides can come together and come to a solution certainly sounds reasonable.
Senator Gelser. Oh, did you want to respond to that? Okay, Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to push back a little bit on the ability for the families to redress. I think it's really difficult. You've got a family that was trying hard to advocate for their child, couldn't get through the IEP process, what the child needed in order to access and make progress in the general curriculum, which one could argue that the child is guaranteed to receive, but the family not wanting to go into a long and protracted complaint process decided that they would just go and do this on their own. And then what they found was that they were being told that they would have to pay $100 an hour twice a week in order for this to happen, $100 a week going to the school district. And so they went to raise that concern. And I would first of all point out that that is discriminatory in terms of who would be able to access that tutor. Lower income families can't pay $200 a week. And the response, rather than trying to figure out how to help this child and lower that cost or make it accessible for the child when the school was already open and when it had already been happening without incident and without a problem, was to completely close the school to all tutors altogether. So that, to me, is not an example of working with the families. And in terms of the slippery slope and getting together and having conversations, I think it's important to have conversations and move forward and work together. But at the end of the day, literally at the end of this day, we will have an exhausted fourth grader trying to keep her eyes open to get through a tutoring session so that she is not devastated and drawing pictures of herself crying in a classroom of smiling children because her school won't allow the tutor that will help her succeed come to the school like they always did before. As a public school student whose parents are taxpayers who aren't even asking the district to pay for it, they're doing it on their own. So I would argue the slippery slope is we have a kid and other kids that aren't going to graduate from high school simply because we won't let a qualified tutor through the door. And that, to me, is a very significant problem. So I hope we can move forward with this. We're at the end of the deadline now. If we need to continue working on the other side, I'm open to that. But my mind is on this little girl tonight. I don't know about the rest of you. I'm tired. I'm looking forward to going home and cooking dinner and calling it a day. And it troubles me that this fourth grader doesn't get to do that because of this policy.
Any other questions? I guess I will take the devil's advocate and all the rest of the people here, since I was a principal at one time. I actually believe that the school district should have reasonable rules, and I would hope that the organization that gives them the
the sample
boilerplate regulations would think about and actually have conversations with us about the kinds of things that are really important. So I understand the liability issues schools get, and there are ways to write policies that everybody has to sign that says they're giving up their liability. So if the student falls or the aide falls or whatever happens, that's going to be their problem, not ours. So there are ways to do some of that. There are ways to make sure that it's handled evenly amongst people. Purpose, all those same things can be written in the policy. I know that that's not the easiest policy because it has other kinds of problems. And if the people are determined not to, they'll close the school right when the bell rings and it's closed, and then solves that problem. And there are schools that do that, because I know that there are schools that don't have any extra time. Once the kids are out of that building, they lock the doors. And so I know that's a part of the issue. But background checks, I wouldn't let people on my building with a kid one-on-one without a background check. So I absolutely agree that that should be a part of a kind of a policy, if they're going to have a policy of any kind. And I do know that it is a recommendation. You're based policy, mm-hmm. and you give a lot of latitude to the school districts with respect to how they go about handling that. So individual school districts can make the deal. That's hard for me because I think we have a system based on individual school districts, and so I have a hard time sometimes doing this. But at the other end of it, everybody would agree that the purpose of the schools in all of our communities is to get every kid as educated as they possibly can. So figuring out ways to do that without putting the school at risk or other kinds of people or kids at risk is really important to me. So I'm just hoping we can have a conversation that lends us to have this conversation. And the truth is, if you come up with something, most school districts will follow it because that's good advice to them. And I just keep thinking there has to be, like Senator Hass was saying, some kind of way to do that that honors both the individual school districts making their decisions and other kinds of things. Anyway, and so Senator Gelser and then Senator Lippman.
And Mr. Chair, two points. Building on yours, there are districts right now that are allowing this to happen, and it has not caused problems for their school districts, and the school districts have not fallen apart. And there are libraries across the state where kids are meeting with their tutors in the libraries, and it's not created a scandal or a devastation to public education or public libraries. And then the second piece is, I did not initially, when I heard about this, think this is something that we do with a bill. I initially thought this is something that we talk to the school district. I was really surprised by the response that I got from the school district, and the school district actually said there would have to be a change in law because they were required by law that did not allow public benefit from private property, and that was the counsel that they were getting from their counsel. So what I took away from working with the school district was that they did not feel comfortable addressing this issue with the families until there was a change in law which said that there was an exception to this public benefit, which is actually what this does. Last thing, also want to be really clear, in any amendment moving forward, we are not asking that the school be open a minute longer or that a room be open any longer than it already would be, same with a library, or that new spaces be made available, and certainly aren't asking that anything be opened earlier or later. It's just if a student would already have access to that space at that time, they would be able to bring their tutor with them.
Thank you. Senator Lipscomb.
Just to set the record of the sample policy that you provided for us, it says use of district facilities for private gain, the district buildings or facilities for private gain will be allowed for any purpose involving private gain only when, and then there's a series of or clause, and one of the or clauses is a worthy educational, civic, or charitable purpose will be served. This is certainly a educational purpose, and those aren't ands. It doesn't have to be educational and charitable. It's educational or civic or charitable purpose, and this seems to fall cleanly within the policy that your board has already published. That we have a school district that's not cooperating is a different issue potentially, but what I would hope was we would use that as a springboard to solve this problem.
And I think all of the people up here, except the libraries, because I don't know them as well, sorry about that, all of the schools from your base policy have their own personal authority to do this, right? We're not disagreeing with that. The disagreement is over their local control on how they want to handle it. That's what, yes, I'm hearing from everybody. Okay.
Yes. Chair Roebling, could I clarify one thing?
We'd love to.
The issue that had that the librarians raised with me, the public librarians raised with me,
right,
was a tutor from a private company coming in with a number of students and tying up space for a length of time so that other people didn't have access to it. And they have policies to address that.
Okay.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I think this clearly was not... I would be also very open to any amendment that made it clear this isn't to allow somebody to basically open a business that is run only out of a school where that becomes the facility and they don't have to rent a space for group things. We're talking about a kid that is in a place anyway. The person comes.
Okay. Senator Hass, okay. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else, again, who got excited about this bill and wants to testify now that hadn't done it before? As I look around, I don't see anyone. So we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 1002, and we'll talk together and figure out where we want to go from this next. Thank you very much. With that, we're going to move to work sessions, and we're going to start with Senate Bill 182. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 182, and is Hilda here? Oh, there you are. You were hiding, Hilda. That was impressive. I tell people right down the aisle is a bad place, but you found a way to do that. So Before we have our work session, there's an amendment that really pretty much, that does a lot of things, and I thought it would be best for people to hear what we're doing with this bill and what the amendments are before we take a vote. So with that, Hilda, the floor is yours.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and Vice Chair Linthicum and members of the Senate Education Committee. For the record, my name is Hilda Rosselli, and I serve as the Director for Educator Advancement in the Chief Education Office. And as was mentioned by Senator Roblin, I wanted to call to your attention what the Dash 3 amendments are able to accomplish. We, as promised during our earlier hearing, we told you that we were in the process of meeting with a number of stakeholders and organizations and boards and commissions, and we have done so. So we've collected some feedback on language, and we feel that the Dash 3 amendments add language that strengthen the efforts with our Early Learning Council to establish some policies and practices that address the early educator professional learning needs. We also believe this will clarify that the 2017-19 biennium will be used to establish the council to develop the concept of educator networks and to define professional learning priorities for the 2019-21 biennium, and of course take actions that we may need to take in order to establish that process. It will also, these amendments also identify clearly that the council will not be implementing a new funding distribution model until the 1921 biennium. It broadens the language that pertains to educator networks while the council completes design work with key stakeholders this year and brings back recommendations to this committee in the spring of 2018. It ensures that the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission can begin awarding scholarship funds to culturally and linguistically diverse teacher candidates upon passage of the bill. And very importantly, it addresses an omission from the Dash 2 amendments that were specific to Senate Bill 612 that will ensure that a sufficient number of kindergarten through grade 5 teachers will have sufficient training to understand and recognize dyslexia and to implement appropriate instructions. I hope that helps clarify the amendments, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
So any questions? If people don't remember, this was a work group that was started during the interim, and there were a lot of people brought together. I was one of those members for most of the time until I got a hip infection. But the reality was, how do we take a lot of these programs we're doing and start focusing in on what are best practices and how do we move forward in making the best teaching staff in the world? How do we support teachers? How do we support these other programs? The only other question that I would have for you, Hilda, is I've had some conversations about as we move forward on this bill, because it addresses a lot of issues that I think all of us would like to address. One is working with diverse populations of kids, and how do we make those things happen? Mm-hmm. This bill has resources in there for that to work forward on. It also, my other question would be, right now we're in a, I don't know that you know this, but there's a difficult budget sense in our area.
I've heard about that.
So there's times when I think we should make sure that it's moving forward, and mm-hmm. so would it be okay? It doesn't specify it here in the bill, but as we go, if this bill gets sent where we want it to, which is Ways and Means, and have a look at it, that we might fund it to start with for this first half of the biennium and then come back and fund it again to get there so we know it's doing what we want it to do and we have an understanding about the funding moving forward. Any ideas or thoughts about that?
Senator Roblin and Vice Chair Linthicum and members of the committee, the way in which the network is currently established, those funds would be still distributed for the 17-18 year. We would bring you a proposal to Ways and Means of how those funds could be addressing what's already in Senate Bill 182 and in statute. And then the real shift would not occur until we were facing the 1921 year, where you then would have a council bringing you priorities based on 2 years of information from educators, from local districts, that have leveraged their partnerships to try to make the dollars go farther. This the current funding sits, depending on who you speak to, anywhere from 31, 35 million. And those funds will still go out in the 17-18 year and will be used to address some of the projects that we either have ongoing commitments to or which the council at their April meeting is already saying this just is aligning with the recommendations and we need to commit this further. So those are interagency conversations that are happening with the Oregon Department of Ed right now. We know that we need to set aside funding to address Senate Bill 612 and also to look at the other pieces that are in statute that we have a commitment to.
Okay, I guess I'm still... As we go through Ways and Means, we're going to have some really difficult decisions to make. And I just want to make it clear that it may be that we're going to have to look at this, not from this and then have it completed for the next biennium, but looking at this biennium and saying, we're going to fund you this much for the first half, and then we're going to come back next year and look at it again to see where it goes.
Because absolutely.
Every one of these funds that have been there for a long time. I mean, we're not talking about new money. We're talking about, well, it is new money because every year is new money. But we may be looking at each one of them with respect to what we do. And I just want to make sure that that you know that as it comes to Ways and Means and the governor and all those other people know that we may look at this in pockets as we go through the biennium. Is that
absolutely? And we've been providing, working together with Oregon Department of Education to provide some summaries of some of the information that goes beyond what you may have heard in the Ways and Means through the budget meeting.
Okay. So these funds that are currently there are in what pockets?
Well, I would talk about 15 through 17 funding.
Okay.
And that includes our Oregon Mentor Project. That includes the district collaboration grants. That includes the Leading for Learning process that is helping support both current and aspiring administrators. And there's also five projects that have been in place now around Teach Oregon and supporting that work. There was also $2 million, I think, set aside for assessment literacy. That work is happening in pilot districts. And then there would be, there was also attached to this at some point, a one-time amount for civics. And in addition to that, the commitments, as I mentioned, that we knew came out of the 2015 legislative session.
And all of that's included in this conversation about 182?
Yes. I think the significant, excuse me, Senator Roblin, the significant difference is that this now is establishing a process where instead of having one agency that feels very responsible for all of these pieces that are supposed to span the entire career of an educator, we now would be able to form a council that is more permanent in nature that actually includes representatives from our educator prep programs, from our TSPC commission, from our early learning division, from our Oregon Department of Education, from partners who have been engaged in this work, from our providers that are engaged in community-based organizations that are also helping with these things, as well as our association members, so that we can really start to leverage the limited dollars to go much farther and to be more efficient. The second part of that is that the system that will be allowed to evolve with the passage of this bill will start engaging educators in defining what are my professional learning needs and how does that come from the ground up rather than the top down. We listen closely to the educators that have worked with the Deputy Superintendent's Council. I think it's his advisory council. And they talked about the fact that right now, sometimes professional learning is something that is just announced and here it is and you must need it and go to it. And then there's no follow-up. There's no sustained efforts there. So this is an attempt to really redesign that process so that by 1921, we are really able to assure you that the resources that you put forward and dedicate to educators are really maximizing the impact that they can have.
Any other questions or thoughts? From my perspective, this is the way we get going. I know that We're looking at having a real conversation about overall education with Senator Cruz and I. But to me, this is one of those things that helps inform that and make it even a better program. So if there's no other questions, I'll take a motion if you'd be willing to make one.
Certainly. Chair Roblin, I move that we adopt the Dash 3 amendment stated 4-4 to Senate Bill 182.
Senator Lithgow moves that, no, yeah, moves the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 182, dated 4-4-17. Is there any discussion about the amendments? Is there any opposition to the amendments? Seeing none, that passes. Senator Lithgow.
Chair Roblin, I move Senate Bill 182 with the Dash 3 amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to Joint Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Lithgow moves Senate Bill 182 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be sent to Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Yes. Senator Cruz, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And all due respect, we have an administrative structure in education that's basically a train wreck. And our response seems to be to create more government and study more things. And, you know, the intention here is good and laudable. I fully understand that. But until we develop an administrative structure for the P20 system and give the right people some authority over the system, mm-hmm. I think we're just kind of dancing in the wind here a little bit. And I my biggest fear, Mr. Chair, is we put too many other pieces on the table. We're thinning down the soup in the core mission of K-12, and that has concerned me for a couple of years now.
Thank you for that. My only back to you is that there's a lot of these programs that are really important to our teachers moving forward. It's going to take mm-hmm. us more than a year to solve the other problem, and I agree with you yeah. with that. But so I would hope you would consider the bill. Any other comments or thoughts? Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing
no, I okay. just
I understand what you're okay. saying. I just want okay. to make sure I give you a chance.
Okay.
Since there's no opposition, the motion passes and the bill's on its way to Ways and Means. Next, we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1003. Just a reminder of the bill. This is one we just heard.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1003 amends state law relating to dyslexia. Beginning in the 2018-19 school year, it requires school districts to ensure that at least one teacher in kindergarten through grade 5 at each school has received training related to dyslexia. It requires the Oregon Department of Education to develop a list of training opportunities related to dyslexia. It establishes requirements for that list. The bill requires school districts to ensure that every kindergartner or first grader is screened for risk factors of dyslexia. It requires ODE to identify cost-effective screening tests and develop and provide guidance. It requires ODE to submit a report to the interim education committees of the legislature summarizing best practices for screening students and instructional supports related to dyslexia. The bill takes effect July 1st, 2018.
So I will entertain a motion.
Chair Roblin, I move that we adopt the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 1003. The Dash 1 amendments are dated 3/22/17.
Senator Lithgow moves the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 1003, dated 3/22/17. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Seeing none, so that moved. Senator Lithgow.
Chair Roblin, I move Senate Bill 1003 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Lithgow moves Senate Bill 1003 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? I do want to say that I want to thank Morgan Allen in particular for coming together with a group of people and working towards an agreement. And as we saw last week when we had the people here worked well with the dyslexia people to get to this agreement, and I think make it easier for the school districts to comply and do it. So I really appreciate that. So
could we sometime amend a bill to clone Morgan Allen so that all things work out well? Because most things works on work out well.
Most of the time, one Morgan is plenty.
So we've taken care of the amendment. We've gotten the next. Have we got the motion on the floor?
We do.
Okay. So is there any disagreement? I lose myself every once in a while. Seeing none, the bill passes. Just so people know, we had the other dyslexia bill. There was a conversation afterwards to be more clear about it. And the dyslexia parents are all now in agreement with that bill, with the new amendments. You'll see those shortly because we'll have a work session on the bill. So I'll let people know that because I was very pleased when we sat down and talked to people. It was clear we'd been talking past people, and I think they came to a nice agreement that works. And we'll talk about that a little bit more. So with that, we'll close our work session on Senate Bill 1003. And pardon?
Carrier. You need a carrier.
Oh, that's right. We need a carrier. Anybody wish to carry it besides myself? I will carry the bill. Okay, so we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1032. Sorry about that. And with that, Senator Lithcom.
Chair Roblin, I move that we adopt the Dash 1 amendment stated 329 to Senate Bill 1032.
Senator Lithcom moves the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill dated 329-17 to Senate Bill 1032. Is there any discussion about the amendments?
Mr. Chair, just a reminder, this is the Future Farmers Amendment.
Yes. And there may be another one, I think, that it was hard to get it in time for this particular time, but we can do that at another, in ways and means or whatever. It was just it was similar kind of issue. So, but we had the physical and the other stuff, and we decided it was time to get moving and get it on. So with that, is there any discussion on the Dash 1 amendment? Did I do that already? I don't think so. So any?
No, just.
And everybody agrees, so the Dash 1 amendments are there. So now I'll listen to Senator Lithcom one more time and try to remember.
Chair Roblin, I move Senate Bill 1032 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Lithcom moves Senate Bill 1032 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be sent to the subcommittee, sent to refer to Ways and Means by prior reference. I knew I'd get it out of there eventually. Is there any discussion about this? Is there any opposition? Seeing none, the bill passes and moves on to Ways and Means. Thank you, and thank you for all the work. We will close our work session on Senate Bill 1032, and we have a number of bills that I've collected information from people about moving forward, so we'll be posting those for work sessions. If you have any questions, please get a hold of me. And with that, having done all our business, we will close our Senate Education Committee today, April 4th. My daughter's birthday.
Maybe your honey ought to talk to Peter about that.
What's that?
Your honey ought to talk to Peter about that.
What's that day?